futuro. Yo, family, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. And it's Friday. And it's ITT Sound Off.
And we are family.
Yeah, Friday.
We are family. Okay. You can tell we're happy because it's springtime. We're not happy about some other stuff, and we're going to get to our first topic right away. It's an immigration update, which, as you know, we are going to stay on this forever.
Yeah.
On Monday, President Joe Biden lifted the refugee cap to 62,500 after initially keeping the record low limit of 15,000 set by former President Trump. So this effectively raises the number of refugees who can be admitted to the United States through September of this year. Mm. Okay. The last president, Julio, that actually raised the number, it was George H.W. Bush, a Republican.
Little history lesson there.
Okay.
I like it.
So let's just say 62,000, better than 15,000, no es nada.
Okay.
Okay. Now, we also saw this thing, which was a little weird, right? We began to see families being reunited under the Biden administration's task force program to find and reunite separated families. This is good. We're going to talk a little bit about the performative nature of that in a second and how we feel about it. But the truth is that there are still over 22,500 migrant children who were unaccompanied who are in this government's custody. And we're seeing the Biden administration talk about immigration kind of like, oh, we're done. BTDT, you know, been there, done that. It's solved.
I know. It's like, what?
Yeah, right. So here's how White House press secretary, who's so in touch with this issue, Jen Psaki, said on Tuesday.
After 4 years of an immigration system rooted in destructive and chaotic policies, President Biden is taking the challenge head on and is building a fair, orderly, and humane immigration system. That's our objective. And wanted to provide a couple of pieces of data you may have seen, but they've come out since the last time we had a briefing in here. At the end of March, there were more than 5,000 children in Customs and Border Protection patrol stations. Today, that number is approximately 600. The amount of time children spend in CBP facilities is down by 75%, from 131 hours at the end of March to under 30 hours now. Clearly, we're not done. There's a lot of work ahead. Migration is a dynamic and evolving challenge, but the president has a plan and we're working on implementing it.
Okay, I'm revved up.
I mean, you know, everything is so kind of cut and dry there.
Right, the problem's over.
It's kind of like, okay, data's good, number's good, reunite is good. Okay, wait, hop, skip, and a jump in our step.
Yeah, number one, okay, it's so misleading the way Jen Psaki presented that and read from that. You have to see the video of that. It was almost like, I got to do this. The problem's solved. It's so misleading because here's why. You just mentioned it at the beginning, 22,500 kids are still in government care and detained. Just because you're in an HHS center doesn't mean that things are going great, right? And this is a perfect example. There's an AP article this week that talks about all the money that's being given to these HHS providers, one of them, Southwest Key, which you, Maria, did an amazing piece with Antonia Cerejido a couple of years ago about Southwest Key and the problems in these centers.
Let's just say that when you're thinking of Southwest Key, based in Austin, and the notion that they are going to be giving better care because they are a nonprofit, because it was started by a Latino who considers himself a progressive dude, Juan Sanchez. But that person and this organization had the capacity to look at an abandoned Walmart and say, huh,
that's a great place for kids.
It's a great place,
a Walmart,
to house children, you know, in a Walmart. So I am sorry. You can say whatever you want about, you know, well, we do it better. But you know what? The treatment, how the children are treated. I mean, it's documented, Julio. This is why this is so upsetting.
Yeah.
These places, they're given green light year after year after year. This did not start under Trump. Okay. It accelerated under Obama and Biden.
Yeah.
And intensely began under George W. So this is not new. They need to be shut down entirely.
Thing number two, the reunification of families, and it was four. We actually ran a video of one of them from the organization Las Americas in El Paso, totally unedited. It's a video that we put on Latino Rebels that just crushed me emotionally. It's a sliver of hope, but I do think seeing how the media has covered it, it's almost like Biden is doing a victory lap. And we really wanted to focus on the reunification. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was about the moment. Have you been watching the coverage of that too, Maria? Like,
I have to say, I actually chose not to watch that because I feel it is intrusive and performative. This is worrisome to me. And the rollout of Alejandro Mayorkas and Michelle Branet, who used to run the Women's Refugee Commission, who I have deep respect for, and this kind of like, you know, we're going to give you exclusive interviews to tell you. Again, we are going to applaud that this is not Donald Trump doing this and Stephen Miller. But what we are saying is that take it to the next level and stop the crumbs.
Yeah.
I'm done with the crumbs. Interestingly, though, Julio, there is another side of this story, right?
Yeah, Maria, there is another side, and it is the activism that we talked about last week.
So here's the message for me personally, right? I'm a democracy junkie. That's why In the Thick exists, because we believe in democracy, and democracy, it manifests itself in all kinds of forms. So Jurema and I, my daughter and I, were going to go celebrate her birthday on Cinco de Mayo. We wanted to go to one of our favorite museums, MoMA, Museum of Modern Art. And then all of a sudden, my son Raul says, not so fast. Do you know about the 10 weeks of protest against MoMA? It's called the Strike MoMA Campaign through June 11th. It's a coalition of activist groups. Julio, I love the name. International Imagination of Anti-National, Anti-Imperialist Feelings. Oh my God.
Okay.
They are striking. They wrote a letter to the workers of MoMA that basically said, we are protesting people who serve on the board, who get themselves rich off of building the prisons that lock our people up, building the concentration camps that lock up our undocumented family and separate children from their mothers. So sadly, the MoMA called the NYPD to block protesters from coming in and having an action inside MoMA. So I'm just saying, it feels like the summer of activism of 2021 on the heels of the summer of activism of 2020. And I'm here for it. As a journalist, I'm not taking part in it, but I'm ready to see democracy in action.
And then I just have one last question for the Biden administration. By raising the refugee cap, will you now take the 23,000 kids as refugees? That's the question I want to ask. Okay, moving on to our second topic. We actually want to turn to what's happening with global protests, because I don't know about you, Maria, but this week my WhatsApp was burning from all my Colombian friends. So for over a week, protesters in Colombia have been met with extreme police violence. Official data is saying that at least 24 people are dead. That's likely an undercount, because a data from the human rights nonprofit Temblores ONG showed that as of Wednesday, there have been at least 37 deaths, with hundreds of people injured. Also, cases of alleged sexual assault. Okay, so as of this recording on Friday morning, the president of Colombia, Iván Duque, has yet to really say anything. He has yet to condemn the police violence. And actually, the protests started after he proposed a nationwide tax increase. He has since withdrawn that plan, and the finance minister in Colombia has also resigned, but the protests continue. And Emilia Marquez Pisano, who is the sex and gender director at Temblores, was on Democracy Now! This week and spoke about the government's actions. So let's listen.
Emilia, can you give a sense, why do you think the government has responded, the security forces have responded so brutally to these protests?
Well, we cannot be sure of why this is happening. There is obviously some kind of norm that is going on inside the closed doors of the police force. But we can assure that the government has said that the protest is illegitimate. We can say that the government has been calling protesters terrorists. And this has obviously led to more violence. This is obviously a discourse of violence coming from our government. And this, we don't know if it has a direct consequence on the police violence, but it obviously is not helping stop it.
So the U.S. State Department, I think, actually had to put out a statement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was the strongest statement ever, because it was like, this was probably the biggest news out of the Western Hemisphere. But obviously, since we live in the United States, you know, people don't talk about it. But that statement was pretty weak. But I was actually like, you had to talk about it, the State Department. They actually expressed sadness for the deaths, but still showed support for the Colombian government and kind of said, yeah, you know, Iván Duque, you know, why don't you look into this?
Rough spot, yeah.
Yeah, which is like, if you know the history of the U.S. and Colombia, it's like allies, and it's really, really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that many of the police tactics we've seen in Colombia are, wow, what a surprise. The United States exporting police brutality.
Taking the best of the United States.
Exactly. They're basically, you see those examples and you're like, where have I seen this before? Oh, at protests in the United States. So we know, like many countries in Latin America, the U.S. has given hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to Colombia and has trained and armed their forces.
That's why, you know, the fact that there is the word imperialist in those activists is really important. You know,
there you go.
And by the way, you know who else brought up the word imperialist? Oh, just a little flex here. AOC in my interview with her.
That's, we're promoting that for Latino USA a couple of weeks.
Flex, flex.
Coming out soon.
But the point is imperialism. Let's use that perspective because, you know, the United States has a history, of funding, propping up, creating, supporting all over the world. So in East Jerusalem, there have been daily raids by Israeli forces against residents and protesters in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, leading to violent arrests and injuries of dozens of Palestinians. So the violence started after Israeli courts ruled that four Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah would have to be evicted and displaced from their homes to clear space for Israeli settlers this month, with four more families set to be forcibly evicted by August. Now, the families appealed the ruling, and it's hung up in court until early next week. These families have lived in these homes, their homes, since 1956, when East Jerusalem was still under Jordan's control. So you have to remember once again that the United States has a direct hand in this violence because they provide $3.8 billion a year in military aid to Israel, which is going to be used to help evict these families.
Yeah.
And we know that police forces across the U.S. have been trained by Israeli officials. So it's like a bad movie that's repeating itself internationally. It's like Darth Vader versus all of us. And the United States is centrally located in this film. Why did I make film analogy? I don't know.
Okay. Did you just watch Star Wars or something? Or I don't know how that came.
Oh, it's Star Wars week. Okay, that's what it is.
Oh, it's May the 4th be with you. That's what it was.
Dude, thank you for clearing that up. May the 4th.
It's like, why am I quoting Darth Vader?
You see, here at ITT, we seek to clarify all of the mysteries. Now, our final topic is a very quick COVID-19 update. And there is a little bit of good news, family, when it comes to vaccines. On Wednesday, the Biden administration announced that they would finally support waiving patent protections for COVID-19 vaccines as India and other countries around the world are facing intense surges of virus cases. So this would open up vaccine production to other countries to make their own vaccine. Though, of course, the entire process takes time. Some countries don't have the tools or the money to mass manufacture. But, you know, experts have warned that because of this global vaccine inequity, where we're the blessed ones that, you know, we've been able to get vaccinated, but the United States has hoarded doses. So other countries are left dangling. And, you know, there are these very, very concerning mutations. So that's the COVID update. A little bit of good news, but, you know, we're all one planet. So we got to deal with this together. Right, Julio?
Yeah, we are. But it was interesting. I read the moment the announcement of like waiving the patent protections for COVID-19, all of a sudden the stock prices of like Pfizer and Moderna, J&J and AstraZeneca, they all went down.
I mean, it's terrible.
And then you have pharmaceuticals saying, oh no, this is a really bad idea. And I'm like, is it, dude? Like, is it a bad idea? Like, how much do you have to make?
I mean, and that's capitalist inequality right there, where you're like, oh, this is a really bad.
Exactly.
Where it's like, do you understand that the rest of the world is going to get better and they're going to be able to be healthier and alive to buy your products? That's why you want healthy people all around the world. Por Dios.
I mean, Moderna, like, Moderna is like literally in my backyard in Massachusetts. And since they have developed this vaccine, their presence in the local sort of media commerce space, like you see ads in the Globe and you see like they're sponsoring the Red Sox.
Whoa.
Right? All of a sudden it's like Moderna, Moderna, Moderna. And I'm like, whoa, what are you using this money for? You know what I mean? It's like,
thank you.
Are you doing it to save the world or are you like raising your brand awareness? Because I have seen more Moderna signage ever since. Like, it's fascinating. And it's like, do you really need that much money? Sorry, I just,
okay.
It's the Boston in me.
And that's the question for you capitalist imperialists out there. Do you really need that much money? Okay, I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
Well, that was fun. Okay, remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because that was, come on, that was fun, no? Remember, it's because of that other people find out about the show, also because you tell them, so do that.
Yeah.
You can tell people to listen to us on Pandora, Spotify, wherever they get their podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at InTheThickShow. Like us on Facebook. And yeah, tell everyone you know to listen.
And Maria, before we credit our team, because that's the way we end the show.
Yes, sir.
We actually have some bittersweet, but also super exciting news to share. Like, this is like life news. You know, like, this is bittersweet in a good sense. So, fabulous news announcement. Noor Saudi has been promoted to lead producer of In The Thick.
She started as a fellow from the New York Women's Foundation. She is now the lead producer of ITT. Go Noor. Go Noor.
Go Noor. And then our incredible, I can't believe I'm saying this, former lead producer, Nicole Rothwell, is moving over to our Futuro Studios team, which I'm so excited that she is.
Wow.
So we'll be hearing more podcasts from her soon. But Nicole.
Go Nicole.
I mean, Nicole, thank you for everything.
Yeah, Nicole, congratulations. She started as an intern. I'm just saying.
Has taken us to the next level. We're also going to be saying goodbye to our fabulous executive director of Futuro, Erica Dilday.
We love you, Erica.
And we want to thank her for all her love, support, and guidance within The Thick. If people know anything about how we do this show, Erica's been with us sort of doing the final listens and giving us insight. But she's never going to leave the Futuro family. That's what you told me, Maria.
She's close. She's staying real close.
Yeah.
It's just that she got this opportunity that, you know,
yeah,
sometimes a dream job just kind of shows up and you got to do it.
Come on. She's going to head up American Documentary.
Yeah.
Come on.
It's true.
That's a dream.
Which is POV. But, you know, the thing is that Erica is staying close. She's in Harlem.
Yeah.
We know where she lives. We're having a fabulous park party with big ass speakers for her. We love you, Erica, for everything that you have done.
We do love
for
you,
for Futuro,
Erica.
And specifically for In The Thick.
Yeah.
And, you know, now In The Thick is produced by Noor Saudi, Arshana Hatha, our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Lisa Salinas, and our intern, Nicole Basolino, with editorial support these days from Charlotte Manjin, who is our interim ED, and Nicole Rothwell.
You see?
So she's still helping us out, and Julio is also helping out as our interim executive director. So things are happening in beautiful ways at Futuro.
They are.
Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. See you on our next episode, dear listener. Have a beautiful spring. Ooh, Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. Okay, bye.
For all the moms out there, take care, all.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.